Okay, is this microphone kind of working? All right. Well, it is a delight to be here reading with such three fine poets and all of them good friends, and to be in such a welcoming venue with Jimmy and Joan and all of you coming out this evening. Thank you. I'm just going to read three poems from the new book, and the first one is a summer poem set in a park in Finland. It's called Helsinki Accord. The air swept clean by long July light. The light, powdery gravel on the path. The silver and green leaves washing above. Here in Helsinki, I've been learning to count again. Uden, Kaden, Koloman. To say dog and cat. Meeting a mother like and yet unlike my own. Stouter and with a face more round. Maybe it takes the sieve of a foreign language to simplify and clean. Maybe it takes the silence of seven winter months, the heavy stones of dark. I tell myself that I can keep this intimate accord, written though it is on fragile parchment light. But don't we always break these vows? The promise of morning, the high blue dome of noon, the bread of clouds, the shallow cup worn in a granite step. Still, I open up the wrapper from a pastry. Boiled egg and butter, salt, not sweet. And unfold it on this weathered bench, preparing even now to break and eat. Well, I trust you guys as an audience, so I'm going to risk reading a long poem that I wrote in advance of the G20 summit coming to Pittsburgh. And it starts with an epigraph from the book of Daniel. And there, here's the setting. I mean, the Jews are in captivity in Babylon, in exile, and Daniel has been rising in the foreign administration by being able to interpret King Nebuchadnezzar's dreams. And there are three stories packed right into this couple of chapters of Daniel. The first one is that Nebuchadnezzar creates this giant gold statue and commands everybody to bow down to it. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refuse, but they are thrown into a fiery furnace, but they survive. And there's a lesser-known story that Nebuchadnezzar, in his pride, is stricken mad, and he's tethered to an iron ring, and he's eating grass like the beasts of the field until he repents. And finally, there's a story of Belshazzar's feast. Nebuchadnezzar's son is having a big party for his friends and his courtesans, and in the party, they're using the holy vessels from the temple in Jerusalem. And so this hand comes down and writes this message on the wall. Nobody can understand it. And Daniel is there and says, he reads it and he says, "You have been weighed in the balance and found wanting." And then that very night, Belshazzar dies and King Darius takes over the kingdom. Anyhow, there's a very famous engraving by William Blake about Nebuchadnezzar as a beast in the field. And as I thought about that G20 coming to Pittsburgh, I just kept realizing that everything I wanted to say was somehow growing out of Blake. For Blake, kind of the way we look at the world, ideally through a sort of generous, abundant eye of the imagination, really shapes what the world is like. And he contrasts looking at the world through what he calls minute particulars, you know, like seeing the world in a single grain of sand or a bird flying around across the sky in a single bird, seeing a world of delight. He contrasts that with what he thinks of as seeing the starry void, which is the scientific, moral, economic abstractions that turn everything into numbers and laws. So for Blake, the fall is the moment when, in fear of death and our finitude, we start trying to control everything around us by you know, by science, by economic counting, by moral judgment, by hoarding things. Anyhow, so that's a long, long introduction for a fairly long poem, and I'll pause between sections here. And I'll try and indicate some quotes. I write to the G20 leaders in advance of their Pittsburgh summit. And here's the epigraph from Daniel. At the end of the appointed time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes to heaven, and I returned to my right mind. We are all tethered to an iron ring. We have all been eating grass, dreaming uneasy dreams. All of us crazed, all cut off. When I look into the face of Blake's Nebuchadnezzar, I see my own slack mouth, dazed eyes, perplexed, distracted, terrified. But it's you I want to speak with. You, after all, strolled through the hanging gardens, paused on the palace roof to admire the view, savored November oranges while scanning the morning's briefing book. Though we all bowed down, you called for the sound of timbrel, zither, pipe, and horn, furnace that had to burn, that glowed like gold. Everything yearned around it like the sun. Each day we came again with something, bundle of brushwood on our backs, cool melon on a silver tray, a briefing book composed in our own exquisite hand in the learned immortal language of Babylon. Thanks for your response. Too bad you can't take time to meet me here. We might have talked about Blake, who saw God's living fire in minute particulars. Say, a single grain of limestone from the trail that runs past our high-rise jail, pale as a fleck of bone from a crematorium. To Blake, an open door, a stone rolled from an empty sepulcher. Or say, the muffled sound of jostling men, the squeak of shoes from an unseen hardwood floor. Or a man alone in a small, hot room. He spreads a frayed gray prison bath towel out in front of him and leans toward Mecca once again. Or say, a girl in the simplest black dress and polished shoes who stands in a parking lot and gazes up toward a small, wired window on the highest floor. Her hair in beaded braids. She lifts her arms halfway as if to fly, but can't and stays. Let's talk about fear. The starry void of death and finitude, the way it spreads from us in rings. All your textbooks start with that, the cold abstraction of scarcity. From that they build a ring of iron, the solid stone of barn, of cairn, or stone hedge. Battle-hard patrols of soldiers moving out. Rings of the Gobi Desert spreading south. Blake's starts somewhere else. That minute grain of sand, a fleck of fire, a star turned inside out, a woman gazing upwards from a parking lot. Five windows light the cavern man. Through one, he breathes the air. Through one, hears music of the spheres. Through one, can look and see small portions of the eternal world. You've been having dreams no one can interpret. Strapped to a gurney, moving fast along a sterile corridor, metal ventilator for a lung, linked to a furnace by an iron chain, counting every heartbeat. 16, 18, 20, they appear flattened into numbers on a monitor. 30, 34. Your heart is clanking now, your doctor's nod. Black hydra of a catheter. Then this. Outside of Lagos, in a field stripped bare of everything but pipeline, a kid in a no-fear t-shirt and torn shoes, bending his knees and breathing fumes, scoops tapped gasoline from into a rusty can. Then the scene breaks into flame. Don't claim you haven't been warned. Every minute particular is saying something. Scribble on the sidewalk in a child's chalk, tagging that the city workers have been scraping off the walls of our convention center hall. Whatever some young Billy Blake might be etching on his protest sign, he who binds to himself a joy does the winged life destroy. In every infant's cry I hear, the mind-forged manacles appear. Of course it's inscrutable, written in reverse on copper plate as in a mirror, waiting for the bite of vinegar and salt Armagnac, the ghostly wash of aquafortis, to appear. No one in your position has time, of course, for so much detail. You'll be taking off soon, doing your best in preparation on the 8-hour flight, drafts of speeches, close advisors handing you their latest brief on macroeconomics, a moment stolen to call your wife. Still, here's my advice for the opening banquet. I love the beauty of a silver chafing dish, the delicate curve of crystal, too. They could be the serving vessels to the hidden holy ark in any human heart. But when the waiter passes you a hand-tooled copper plate, the flash of a wrist, a mark you glimpse beneath a starched white sleeve, ask him about it. Tattoo or scar? Maybe it's a Star of David, or if he's very old, a number in blue, a faded ghost. There must be a story behind it. Maybe it's a saber, or a rose, or the pans of justice in crude scale. What if finitude is like an open field, a small one, where a king who's lost his mind is tethered on all fours, feeding among the bunch grass, lilies, and the mustard seed, his tangled hair matted with burdock, drenched with dew? What if he wipes his eyes, and what had seemed a starry void becomes a single evening, twilight by a riverside? Two stars seem to rise above the 10th Street Bridge. Mallards putter in the weeds around a half-sunk barge. It's September. Soon they'll be gone from us. Even the one who tarries in his flight to snag a last lucky crust from the oily surface of the Mon. Even that one is a world of delight. Thank you for hanging in there with that. I'm going to close with another summer poem, mercifully very short. Sometimes I worry, for obvious reasons, all the footnotes to the last poem, that some of my poems could seem, you know, too intellectual or too literary. But I believe that the life of the mind and the life of the heart are, you know, all of a piece. So I was reading the great 20th century Hebrew poet Yehuda Amichai, a wonderful poem called Here. And it just seems so extraordinarily humane and lovely and complex. And I found myself thinking, oh, it's just so beautiful. And then I went out for a little walk in my neighborhood and I saw some other things. After reading Amichai's poem called Here, I walk past the girls' softball practice. Scattering of fireflies, cool in evening air. Green expanse of grass. Fragile brown planet of infield, glowing beyond in shadowless ball field light. Lazy plink of bats, all easy and genial. Ripple of laughter, little rills of talk. A slender blonde girl stretches in slow motion to make a catch. Which kind of beauty is worth more? And what kind of counting would dare to ask? Thanks.